This is Audible.
Clipper Audio presents an unabridged recording of Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie, narrated by Lyndon Gregory. This work is copyrighted 1981 by Salman Rushdie. This recording is copyrighted 2009 by W.F. Howes Limited. This Booker Prize-winning novel also won the Booker of Bookers, and is now a classic work of 20th century literature. A multi-layered, multifaceted book, it tells the story of Selim Sinai, born at midnight, the precise moment of independence for his country, India. His story is also the story of a nation finding its identity, of impressions and memories, of people and events, of families and more. Above all, it is Rushdie's fantastical, magical prose that brings the book to life, overflowing with the colours, sights and smells of India. And now, Midnight's Children.
Introduction. In 1975, I published my first novel, Grimus, and decided to use the £700 advance to travel in India as cheaply as possible for as long as I could make the money last. And on that journey of 15-hour bus rides and humble hostelries, Midnight's Children was born. It was the year that India became a nuclear power, and Margaret Thatcher was elected leader of the Conservative Party, and Sheikh Mujib, the founder of Bangladesh, was murdered. When the Bader Meinhof gang was on trial in Stuttgart, and Bill Clinton married Hillary Rodham, and the last Americans were evacuated from Saigon, and Generalissimo Franco died. In Cambodia, it was the Khmer Rouge's bloody year zero. E.L. Doctorow published Ragtime that year, and David Mamet wrote American Buffalo. And Eugenio Montale won the Nobel Prize. And just after my return from India, Mrs. Indira Gandhi was convicted of election fraud, and 1 week after my 28th birthday, she declared a state of emergency and assumed tyrannical powers. It was the beginning of a long period of darkness, which would not end until 1977. I understood almost at once that Mrs. G had somehow become central to my still tentative literary plans. I had wanted for some time to write a novel of childhood, arising from my memories of my own childhood in Bombay. Now, having drunk deeply from the well of India, I conceived a more ambitious plan. I remembered a minor character named Selim Sinai, born at the midnight moment of Indian independence, who had appeared in the abandoned draft of a stillborn novel called The Antagonist. As I placed Selim at the centre of my new scheme, I understood that his time of birth would oblige me immensely to increase the size of my canvas. If he and India were to be paired, I would need to tell the story of both twins. Then Selim, ever a striver for meaning, suggested to me that the whole of modern Indian history happened as it did because of him. That history, the life of his nation twin, was somehow all his fault. With that immodest proposal, the novel's characteristic tone of voice, comically assertive, unrelentingly garrulous, and with, I hope, a growing pathos in its narrator's increasingly tragic overclaiming, came into being. I even made the boy and the country identical twins. When the sadistic geography teacher, Emil Zagalo, giving the boys a lesson in human geography, compares Salim's nose to the Deccan Peninsula, the cruelty of his joke is also, obviously, mine. There were many problems along the way, most of them literary, some of them urgently practical. When we returned from India, I was broke. The novel in my head was clearly going to be long and strange and take quite a while to write, and in the meanwhile, I had no money. As a result, I was forced back into the world of advertising. Before we left, I had worked for a year or so as a copywriter at the London office of the Ogilvy and Mather Agency, whose founder, David Ogilvy, immortally instructed us that the consumer is not a moron, she is your wife, and whose creative director, and my boss, was Dan Ellerington, a man of rumoured Romanian origins, with a command of English that was, let us say, eccentric, so that, according to mirthful company legend, He once had to be forcibly restrained from presenting to the Milk Marketing Board a successor campaign to the famous Drink a Pint of Milk a Day, which would be based on the amazing, the positively Romanian slogan, Milk goes down like a dose of salts. In those less hard-nosed times, Ogilvy's was prepared to employ a few oddball creative people on a part-time basis, and I managed to persuade them to rehire me as one of that happy breed. I worked 2 or 3 days a week, essentially job-sharing with another part-timer, the writer Jonathan Gaythorne Hardy, author of The Rise and Fall of the British Nanny. On Friday nights, I would come home to Kentish Town from the agency's offices near Waterloo Bridge, take a long, hot bath, wash the week's commerce away, and emerge, or so I told myself, as a novelist. As I look back, I feel a touch of pride at my younger self's dedication to literature, which gave him the strength of mind to resist the blandishments of the enemies of promise. The sirens of Adland sang sweetly and seductively, but I thought of Odysseus lashing himself to the mast of his ship and somehow stayed on course. Still, advertising taught me discipline, forcing me to learn how to get on with whatever task needed getting on with, and ever since those days I have treated my writing simply as a job to be done, refusing myself all, well, most luxuries of artistic temperament. And it was at my desk at Ogilvy's that I remember becoming worried that I didn't know what my new novel was to be called. I took several hours off from the important work of coming up with campaigns for fresh cream cakes, naughty but nice, Aero chocolate bars, Irresistibubble, and the Daily Mirror newspaper, Look into the Mirror Tomorrow, You'll Like What You See, to solve the problem. In the end, I had two titles, and I couldn't choose between them, Midnight's Children and Children of Midnight. I typed them, one after the other, over and over, and then all at once, I understood. There was no contest. That Children of Midnight was a banal title, and Midnight's Children, a good one. To know the title was also to understand the book better. And after that, it became easier, a little easier, to write. I have written and spoken elsewhere about my debt to the oral narrative traditions of India, also to those great Indian novelists Jane Austen and Charles Dickens. Austen for her portraits of brilliant women caged by the social convention of their time, women whose Indian counterparts I knew well. Dickens for his great, rotting, Bombay-like city and his ability to root his larger-than-life characters and surrealist imagery in a sharply observed, almost hyper-realistic background out of which the comic and fantastic elements of his work seemed to grow organically, becoming intensifications of and not escapes from the real world. I have probably said enough, too, about my interest in creating a literary idiolect that allowed the rhythms and thought patterns of Indian languages to blend with the idiosyncrasies of Hinglish and Bambaya, the polyglot street slang of Bombay. The novel's interest in the slippages and distortions of memory will also, I think, be evident enough to the reader. This may, however, be an appropriate moment to give thanks to the original people from whom my fictional characters sprang. My family, my ayah, Miss Mary Menezes, and my childhood friends. My father was so angry about the character of Amit Sanai that he refused to speak to me for many months. Then he decided to forgive me, which annoyed me so much that for several more months I refused to speak to him. I had been more worried about my mother's reaction to the book, but she immediately understood that it was just a story. Salim isn't you, Amina isn't me, they're all just characters. Thus demonstrating that her level head was a lot more use to her than my father's Cambridge University education in English literature was to him. My sister Samin, who really was called the brass monkey as a girl, was also happy with the use I'd made of my raw material, even though some of that raw material was her. Of the reactions of my boyhood friends and schoolmates, Arif Tayabali, Darab and Fudli Talia Khan, Keith Stevenson, and Percy Karanja. I can't be sure, but I must thank them for having contributed bits of themselves, not always the best bits, to the characters of Sonny Ibrahim, Ice Slice and Hair Oil, and Fat Purse, and Glandy Keith. Evie Burns was born out of an Australian girl, Beverly Burns, the first girl I ever kissed. The real Beverly was no bicycle queen, though, and I lost touch with her after she returned to Australia. Marsha Miovich, the champion breaststroker owed something to the real-life Alenka Miyevich. But a couple of years ago, I received a letter about Midnight's children from Alenka's father in Serbia, in which he mentioned, a little crushingly, that his daughter had no memory of ever having met me during her childhood years in Bombay. So it goes. Between the adored and the adorer falls the shadow. And as for Mary Menezes, my second mother, who never really loved a revolutionary nursing home employee or swapped any babies at birth, who lived to 100, who never married and always called me her son, she was illiterate, even though she spoke 7 or 8 languages. So she didn't read the book, but did tell me one afternoon in Bombay in 1982 how proud she was of its success. If she had any objection to what I'd made her character do, she didn't mention it. I reached the end of Midnight's Children in mid-1979 and sent it to my friend and editor Liz Calder at Jonathan Cape. I afterwards learned that the first reader's report had been brief and forbiddingly negative. The author should concentrate on short stories until he has mastered the novel form. Liz asked for a second report, and this time I was luckier, because the second reader, Susanna Clapp, was enthusiastic, as, after her, was another eminent publishing figure, the editor Catherine Carver. Liz bought the book, and soon afterwards so did Bob Gottlieb, at Alfred Knopf. I quit my part-time copywriting job. I had moved on from Ogilvy & Mather to another agency, Ayer Barker Hegeman. "Oh," the creative director said when I tendered my resignation, "you want a rise?" "No," I explained, "I was just giving notice, as required, so that I could leave and become a full-time writer." "I see," he said. "You want a big rise." But on the night Midnight's Children won the Booker, he sent me a telegram of congratulations. "One of us made it," it read. Liz Calder's editing saved me from making at least 2 bad mistakes. The manuscript, as originally submitted, contained a second audience character, an offstage woman journalist to whom Salim was sending the written pages of his life story, which he also read aloud to the mighty pickle woman, Padma. All the book's readers at Cape agreed that this character was redundant, and I'm extremely glad I took their advice. Liz also helped me untangle a knot in the timeline. In the submitted manuscript, the story jumped from the Indo-Pakistani War of 1965 to the end of the Bangladesh War, then circled back to tell the story of Salim's role in that conflict, caught up with itself at the surrender of the Pakistani army, and then went on. Liz felt there were too many temporal shifts here, and the reader's concentration was broken by them. I agreed to restructure the story chronologically, and again, I'm very relieved that I did. The role of the great publishing editor is often effaced by the editor's modesty. But without Liz Calder, Midnight's Children would have been something rather less than she helped it to become. The novel's publication was delayed by a series of industrial strikes, but in the end it was published in London in early April 1981, and on April the 6th, my first wife Clarissa Luard and I threw a party at our friend Tony Stokes' little art gallery in Langley Court, Covent Garden, to celebrate it. I still have the invitation tucked into my first received copy of the novel, and can remember feeling, above all, relieved. When I finished the book, I suspected that I might at last have written something good, but I was not sure if anyone else would agree, and I told myself that if the book were generally disliked, it would mean that I probably didn't know what a good book was, and to stop wasting my time trying to write one. So there was a lot riding on the novel's reception, and, fortunately, the reviews were good. Hence the high spirits in Covent Garden that spring night. In the West, people tended to read Midnight's Children as a fantasy, while in India, people thought of it as pretty realistic, almost a history book. "I could have written your book," one reader told me when I was lecturing in India in 1982. "I know all that stuff." But it was wonderfully well-liked almost everywhere, and changed its author's life. One reader who didn't care for it, however, was Mrs. Indira Gandhi. And in 1984, 3 years after its publication, she was Prime Minister again by this time, she brought an action against it, claiming to have been defamed by one single sentence. It appeared in the penultimate paragraph of Chapter 28, A Wedding, a paragraph in which Selim provides a brief account of Mrs. Gandhi's life. This was it. It has often been said that Mrs. Gandhi's younger son Sanjay accused his mother of being responsible, through her neglect, for his father's death, and that this gave him an unbreakable hold over her, so that she became incapable of denying him anything. Tame stuff, you might think, not really the kind of thing a thick-skinned politician would usually sue a novelist for mentioning, and an odd choice of casus belli in a book that excoriated Indra for the many crimes of the emergency. After all, it was a thing much said in India in those days, had often been in print, and was indeed reprinted prominently in the Indian press. The sentence Mrs. Gandhi is afraid of read one front-page headline, after she brought her action for defamation. Yet she sued nobody else. Before the book's publication, Cape's lawyers had been worried about my criticisms of Mrs. Gandhi, and had asked me to write them a letter in support of the claims I was making. In this letter, I justified the text to their satisfaction, except with regard to one sentence which, as I said, was hard to substantiate, as it was about three people, two of whom were dead, while the third would be the one suing us. However, I argued, as I was clearly characterising the information as gossip, and as it had been printed before, we should be all right. The lawyers agreed, and then, 3 years later, this one sentence, the novel's Achilles' heel, was the very sentence Mrs. Gandhi tried to spear. This was not, in my view, a coincidence. The case never came to court. The law of defamation is highly technical, and to repeat a defamatory rumour is to commit the defamation oneself, so technically we were in the wrong. Mrs. Gandhi was not asking for damages, only for the sentence to be removed from future editions of the book. The only defence we had was a high-risk route. We would have had to argue that her actions during the emergency were so heinous that she could no longer be considered a person of good character and could therefore not be defamed. In other words, we would have had, in effect, to put her on trial for her misdeeds. But if, in the end, a British court refused to accept that the Prime Minister of India was not a woman of good character, then we would be, not to put too fine a point upon it, royally screwed. Unsurprisingly, this was not the strategy which Cape wished to follow. And when it became clear that she was also willing to accept that this was her sole complaint against the book, I agreed to settle the matter. It was, after all, an amazing admission she was making, considering what the emergency chapters of Midnight's Children were about. Her willingness to make such an admission felt to me like an extraordinary validation of the novel's portrait of those emergency years. The reaction to the settlement in India was not favourable to the Prime Minister. A few short weeks later, stunningly, she was dead, assassinated on October the 31st, 1984, by her Sikh bodyguards. "All of us who love India," I wrote in a newspaper article, "are in mourning today. In spite of our disagreements, I meant every word." This is by now an old story. I rehearse it here in part because I worried from the beginning that incorporating such momentarily hot contemporary material in the novel was a risk. And by that I meant a literary risk, not a legal one. One day I knew the subject of Mrs. Gandhi and the emergency would cease to be current, would no longer exercise anyone over much. And at that point, I told myself my novel would either get worse, because it would lose the power of topicality, or else it would get better, because once the topical had faded, the novel's literary architecture would stand alone, and even, perhaps, be better appreciated. Clearly, I hoped for the latter, but there was no way to be sure. The fact that Midnight's Children is still of interest 25 years after it first appeared is, therefore, reassuring. In 1981, Margaret Thatcher was British Prime Minister. The American hostages in Iran were released, President Reagan was shot and wounded, there were race riots across Britain, the Pope was shot and wounded, Picasso's Guernica went back to Spain, and President Sadat of Egypt was assassinated. It was the year of V.S. Naipaul's Among the Believers, and Robert Stone's A Flag for Sunrise, and John Updike's Rabbit is Rich. Like all novels, Midnight's Children is a product of its moment in history, touched and shaped by its time in ways which its author cannot wholly know. I'm very glad that it still seems like a book worth reading in this very different time. If it can pass the test of another generation or two, it may endure. I will not be around to see that, but I am happy that I saw it leap the first hurdle. Salman Rushdie, December 25, 2005, London. Book 1, The Perforated Sheet. I was born in the city of Bombay. Once upon a time... No, that won't do. There's no getting away from the date. I was born in Dr. Nalaka's nursing home on August 15th, 1947. And the time? The time matters too. Well then, at night. No, it's important to be more... On the stroke of midnight, as a matter of fact. Clock hands joined palms in respectful greeting as I came. Oh, spell it out, spell it out! At the precise instant of India's arrival at independence, I tumbled forth into the world. There were gasps, and outside the window fireworks and crowds. A few seconds later, my father broke his big toe, but his accident was a mere trifle when set beside what had befallen me in that benighted moment, because, thanks to the occult tyrannies of those blandly saluting clocks, I had been mysteriously handcuffed to history, my destinies indissolubly chained to those of my country. For the next 3 decades there was to be no escape. Soothsayers had prophesied me. Newspapers celebrated my arrival. Politicos ratified my authenticity. I was left entirely without a say in the matter. I, Salim Sinai, later variously called Snotnose, Stainface, Baldy, Sniffer, Buddha, and even Peace of the Moon, had become heavily embroiled in fate. At the best of times, a dangerous sort of involvement. And I couldn't even wipe my own nose at the time. Now, however, time, having no further use for me, is running out. I will soon be 31 years old. Perhaps, if my crumbling, overused body permits. But I have no hope of saving my life. Nor can I count on having even 1,000 nights and a night. I must work fast, faster than Scheherazade, if I'm to end up meaning, yes, meaning, something. I admit it, above all things, I fear absurdity. And there are so many stories to tell, too many. Such an excess of intertwined lives, events, miracles, places, rumours, so dense a commingling of the improbable and the mundane. I have been a swallower of lives, and to know me, just the one of me, you'll have to swallow the lot as well. Consumed multitudes are jostling and shoving inside me, and guided only by the memory of a large white bedsheet with a roughly circular hole some 7 inches in diameter cut into the centre, clutching at the dream of that holy, mutilated square of linen, which is my talisman, my open sesame. I must commence the business of remaking my life from the point at which it really began, some 32 years before anything as obvious as present, as my clock-ridden, crime-stained birth. The sheet, incidentally, is stained too, with 3 drops of old faded redness. As the Quran tells us, "Recite in the name of the Lord thy Creator, who created man from clots of blood." One Kashmiri morning in the early spring of 1915, my grandfather, Adam Aziz, hit his nose against a frost-hardened tussock of earth while attempting to pray. 3 drops of blood plopped out of his left nostril, hardened instantly in the brittle air, and lay before his eyes on the prayer mat, transformed into rubies. Lurching back until he knelt with his head once more upright, he found that the tears which had sprung to his eyes had solidified too, and at that moment, as he brushed diamonds contemptuously from his lashes, he resolved never again to kiss earth for any god or man. This decision, however, made a hole in him, a vacancy in a vital inner chamber, leaving him vulnerable to women and history. Unaware of this at first, despite his recently completed medical training, he stood up, rolled the prayer mat into a thick cheroot, and holding it under his right arm, surveyed the valley through clear, diamond-free eyes. The world was new again. After a winter's gestation in its eggshell of ice, the valley had beaked its way out into the open, moist, and yellow. The new grass bided its time underground, The mountains were retreating to their hill stations for the warm season. In the winter, when the valley shrank under the ice, the mountains closed in and snarled like angry jaws around the city on the lake. In those days, the radio mast had not been built, and the temple of Sankara Acharya, a little black blister on a khaki hill, still dominated the streets and lake of Srinagar. In those days, there was no army camp at the lakeside, no endless snakes of camouflaged trucks and jeeps clogged the narrow mountain roads. No soldiers hid behind the crests of the mountains past Baramulla and Gulmarg. In those days, travellers were not shot as spies if they took photographs of bridges. And, apart from the Englishmen's houseboats on the lake, the valley had hardly changed since the Mughal Empire, for all its springtime renewals. But my grandfather's eyes, which were, like the rest of him, 25 years old, saw things differently, and his nose had started to itch. To reveal the secret of my grandfather's altered vision, he had spent 5 years, 5 springs, away from home. The tussock of earth, crucial though its presence was, as it crouched under a chance wrinkle of the prayer mat, was at bottom no more than a catalyst. Now, returning, he saw through travelled eyes. Instead of the beauty of the tiny valley circled by giant teeth, he noticed the narrowness, the proximity of the horizon, and felt sad to be at home and feel so utterly enclosed. He also felt, inexplicably, as though the old place resented his educated, stethoscoped return. Beneath the winter ice, it had been coldly neutral. But now there was no doubt. The years in Germany had returned him to a hostile environment. Many years later, when the hole inside him had been clogged up with hate, and he came to sacrifice himself at the shrine of the black stone god in the temple on the hill, he would try and recall his childhood springs in paradise, the way it was before travel and tussocks and army tanks messed everything up. On the morning when the valley, gloved in a prayer mat, punched him on the nose, he had been trying, absurdly, to pretend that nothing had changed. So he had risen in the bitter cold of 4:15, washed himself in the prescribed fashion, dressed and put on his father's astrakhan cap, after which he had carried the roll cheroot of the prayer mat into the small lakeside garden in front of their old dark house and unrolled it over the waiting tussock. The ground felt deceptively soft under his feet and made him simultaneously uncertain and unwary. "In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful," the exordium spoken with hands joined before him like a book, comforted a part of him, made another, larger part feel uneasy. "Praise be to Allah, Lord of the creation." But now Heidelberg invaded his head. Here was Ingrid, briefly his Ingrid, her face scorning him for this Mecca-turned parroting. Here, their friends Oscar and Ilse Lubin, the anarchists, mocking his prayer with their anti-ideologies. "The compassionate, the merciful king of the last judgment." Heidelberg, in which, along with medicine and politics, he learned that India, like radium, had been discovered by the Europeans. Even Oscar was filled with admiration for Vasco da Gama. And this was what finally separated Adam Aziz from his friends. This belief of theirs that he was somehow the invention of their ancestors. "You alone we worship, and to you alone we pray for help." So here he was, despite their presence in his head, attempting to reunite himself with an earlier self, which ignored their influence, but knew everything it ought to have known about submission, for example, about what he was doing now. As his hands, guided by old memories, fluttered upwards, thumbs pressed to ears, fingers spread, as he sank to his knees.
"Guide us to the straight path, the path of those whom you have favoured."
But it was no good. He was caught in a strange middle ground, trapped between belief and disbelief. And this was only a charade, after all. "Not of those who have incurred your wrath, nor of those who have gone astray." My grandfather bent his forehead towards the earth. Forward he bent, and the earth, prayer mat covered, curved up towards him. And now it was the tussock's time. At one and the same time, a rebuke from Ilse Oscar Ingrid Heidelberg, as well as valley and God.
It smote him upon the point of the nose. 3 drops fell. There were rubies and diamonds. And my grandfather, lurching upright, made a resolve, stood, rolled cheroot, stared across the lake, and was knocked for ever into that middle place, unable to worship a god in whose existence he could not wholly disbelieve. Permanent alteration. A hole.
The young, newly qualified Dr. Adam Aziz stood facing the springtime lake, sniffing the whiffs of change, while his back, which was extremely straight, was turned upon yet more changes. His father had had a stroke in his absence abroad, and his mother had kept it a secret. His mother's voice whispering stoically,
"Because your studies were too important, son."
This mother, who had spent her life housebound in Purda, had suddenly found enormous strength and gone out to run the small gemstone business, turquoises, rubies, diamonds, which had put Adam through medical college, with the help of a scholarship. So he returned to find the seemingly immutable order of his family turned upside down, his mother going out to work while his father sat hidden behind the veil which the stroke had dropped over his brain. In a wooden chair, in a darkened room, he sat and made bird noises. 30 different species of bird visited him and sat on the sill outside his shuttered window, conversing about this and that. He seemed happy enough. And already I can see the repetitions beginning, because didn't my grandmother also find enormous... And the stroke, too, was not the only, and the brass monkey had her birds. The curse begins already, and we haven't even got to the noses yet. The lake was no longer frozen over. The thaw had come rapidly. As usual, many of the small boats, the shikaras, had been caught napping, which was also normal. But while these sluggards slept on dry land, snoring peacefully beside their owners, the oldest boat was up at the crack, as old folk often are, and was therefore the first craft to move across the unfrozen lake. Tai's shikara, this, too, was customary. Watch how the old boatman, Tai, makes good time through the misty water, standing stooped over the back of his craft. How his oar, a wooden heart on a yellow stick, drives jerkily through the weeds. In these parts, he's considered very odd because he rows standing up, among other reasons. Tai, bringing an urgent summons to Dr. Aziz, is about to set history in motion. While Adam, looking down into the water, recalls what Tai taught him years ago.
"The ice is always waiting, Adam Baba, just under the water skin."
Adam's eyes are a clear blue, the astonishing blue of mountain sky, which has a habit of dripping into the pupils of Kashmiri men. They have not forgotten how to look. They see there, like the skeleton of a ghost, just beneath the surface of Lake Dal. The delicate tracery, the intricate crisscross of colourless lines, the cold waiting veins of the future. His German years, which have blurred so much else, haven't deprived him of the gift of seeing. Tai's gift. He looks up, sees the approaching V of Tai's boat, waves a greeting. Tai's arm rises, but this is a command.
"Wait!"
My grandfather waits, and during this hiatus, as he experiences the last piece of his life, a muddy, ominous sort of piece, I had better get round to describing him. Keeping out of my voice the natural envy of the ugly man for the strikingly impressive, I record that Dr. Aziz was a tall man. Pressed flat against a wall of his family home, he measured 25 bricks, a brick for each year of his life, or just over 6'2". A strong man also. His beard was thick and red, and annoyed his mother, who said only Hajjis men who had made the pilgrimage to Mecca should grow red beards. His hair, however, was rather darker. His sky eyes you know about. Ingrid had said, "They went mad with the colours when they made your face." But the central feature of my grandfather's anatomy was neither colour nor height, neither strength of arm nor straightness of back. There it was, reflected in the water, undulating like a mad plantain in the centre of his face. Adam Aziz, waiting for Tai, watches his rippling nose. It would have dominated less dramatic faces than his easily, even on him. It is what one sees first and remembers longest. "A Sirin nose," Ilse Lubin said. And Oscar added, "A proboscissimus." Ingrid announced, "You could cross a river on that nose." Its bridge was wide. My grandfather's nose, nostrils flaring, curvaceous as dancers. Between them swells the nose's triumphal arch, first up and out, then down and under, sweeping in to his upper lip with a superb and, at present, red-tipped flick. An easy nose to hit a tussock with. I wish to place on record my gratitude to this mighty organ. If not for it, who would ever have believed me to be truly my mother's son? My grandfather's grandson? This colossal apparatus which was to be my birthright too. Dr. Aziz's nose, comparable only to the trunk of the elephant-headed god Ganesh, established incontrovertibly his right to be a patriarch. It was Tai who taught him that too. When young Adam was barely past puberty, the dilapidated boatman said, "That's a nose to start a family on, my princeling. There'd be no mistaking whose brood they were. Mughal emperors would have given their right hands for noses like that one. There are dynasties waiting inside it." And here Tai lapsed into coarseness. "Like snot!" On Adam Aziz the nose assumed a patriarchal aspect. On my mother it looked noble and a little long-suffering. On my aunt Emerald, snobbish. On my aunt Alia, intellectual. On my uncle Hanif, it was the organ of an unsuccessful genius. My uncle Mustafa made it a second-rate sniffer. The brass monkey escaped it completely, but on me, it was something else again. But I mustn't reveal all my secrets at once. Tai is getting nearer, he who revealed the power of the nose, and who is now bringing my grandfather the message which will catapult him into his future, is stroking his shikara through the early morning lake. Nobody could remember when Tai had been young. He had been plying this same boat, standing in the same hunched position across the Dal and Nagin lakes forever, as far as anyone knew. He lived somewhere in the insanitary bowels of the old wooden house quarter, and his wife grew lotus roots and other curious vegetables on one of the many floating gardens, lilting on the surface of the spring and summer water. Tai himself cheerily admitted he had no idea of his age, neither did his wife. He was, she said, already leathery when they married. His face was a sculpture of wind on water, ripples made of hide. He had two golden teeth and no others. In the town he had few friends. Few boatmen or traders invited him to share a hookah when he floated past the shikara moorings, or one of the lake's many ramshackle waterside provision stores and tea shops. The general opinion of Tai had been voiced long ago by Adam Aziz's father, the gemstone merchant. His brain fell out with his teeth. But now old Aziz Saab sat lost in bird tweets, while Tai simply grandly continued. It was an impression the boatman fostered by his chatter, which was fantastic, grandiloquent, and ceaseless, and, as often as not, addressed only to himself. Sound carries over water, and the lake people giggled at his monologues, but with undertones of awe and even fear. Or because the old half-wit knew the lakes and hills better than any of his detractors, fear because of his claim to an antiquity so immense it defied numbering, and moreover hung so lightly round his chicken's neck that it hadn't prevented him from winning a highly desirable wife and fathering four sons upon her. And a few more, the story went, on other lakeside wives. The young bucks at the shikara moorings were convinced he had a pile of money hidden away somewhere. A hoard, perhaps, of priceless golden teeth rattling in a sack like walnuts. Years later, when Uncle Puffs tried to sell me his daughter by offering to have her teeth drawn and replaced in gold, I thought of Tai's forgotten treasure. And as a child, Adam Aziz had loved him. He made his living as a simple ferryman, despite all the rumours of wealth, taking hay and goats and vegetables and wood across the lakes for cash. People, too. When he was running his taxi service, he erected a pavilion in the centre of the shikara, a gay affair of flowered pattern curtains and canopy, with cushions to match, and deodorized his boat with incense. The sight of Tai's shikara approaching, curtains flying, had always been for Dr. Aziz one of the defining images of the coming of spring. Soon the English Saabs would arrive, and Tai would ferry them to the Shalimar Gardens and the King's Spring, chattering and pointy and stooped. He was the living antithesis of Oscar Ilse Ingrid's belief in the inevitability of change, a quirky, enduring, familiar spirit of the valley, a watery Caliban, rather too fond of cheap Kashmiri brandy. Memory of my blue bedroom wall, on which, next to the PM's letter, the boy Raleigh hung for many years, gazing rapturously at an old fisherman in what looked like a red dhoti who sat on, what, driftwood? And pointed out to sea as he told his fishy tales. And the boy, Adam, my grandfather-to-be, fell in love with the boatman Ty precisely because of the endless verbiage which made others think him cracked. It was magical talk, words pouring from him like fool's money past his two gold teeth, laced with hiccups and brandy, soaring up to the most remote Himalayas of the past, then swooping shrewdly on some present detail. Adam's nose, for instance, to vivisect its meaning like a mouse. This friendship had plunged Adam into hot water with great regularity. Boiling water, literally, while his mother said, "We'll kill that boatman's bugs if it kills you." But still the old soliloquist would dawdle in his boat at the garden's lakeside toes, and Aziz would sit at his feet until voices summoned him indoors to be lectured on Ty's filthiness and warned about the pillaging armies of germs his mother envisaged leaping from that hospitably ancient body onto her son's starched white loose pyjamas. But always Adam returned to the water's edge to scan the mists for the ragged reprobate's hunched-up frame steering its magical boat through the enchanted waters of the mooring.
"But how old are you really, Taji?"
Dr. Aziz, adult, red-bearded, slanting towards the future, remembers the day he asked the unaskable question. For an instant, silence, noisier than a waterfall. The monologue interrupted, slap of oar in water. He was riding in the Shikara with Tai, squatting amongst goats on a pile of straw, in full knowledge of the stick and bathtub waiting for him at home. He had come for stories, and with one question had silenced the storyteller.
"No, tell Taji, how old, truly?"
And now, a brandy bottle materializing from nowhere, cheap liquor from the folds of the great warm chugger coat. Then a shudder, a belch, a glare, glint of gold, and at last speech.
"How old, you ask? How old, you little wet-head, you nosy?"
Ty, forecasting the fisherman on my wall, pointed at the mountains.
"So old, Nuku."
Adam the Nuku, the nosy one, followed his pointing finger.
"I have watched the mountains being born. I have seen the emperors die. Listen, listen, Nuku."
The brandy bottle again, followed by brandy voice and words more intoxicating than booze.
"I saw that, I said that Christ when he came to Kashmir. Smile, smile. It is your history I am keeping in my head. Once it was set down in old lost books. Once I knew where there was a grave with pierced feet carved on the tombstone, which bled once a year. Even my memory is going now, but I know, although I can't read."
Illiteracy dismissed with a flourish. Literature crumbled beneath the rage of his sweeping hand, which sweeps again to chugger pocket, to brandy bottle, to lips chapped with cold. Ty always had woman's lips.
"Naku, listen, listen. I have seen plenty. Yeah, you should have seen that Isa when he came. Beard down to his balls, bald as an egg on his head. He was old and fagged out, but he knew his manners.
'You first, Taji,' he'd say. 'And please to sit.' Always a respectful tongue. He never called me crackpot, never called me too either. Always arp, polite, see? And what an appetite! Such a hunger, I would catch my ears in fright. Saint or devil, I swear, he could eat a whole kid in one go. 'And so what?' I told him. 'Eat! Fill your hole. A man comes to Kashmir to enjoy life, or to end it, or both.'
His work was finished. He just came up here to live it up a little."
Mesmerized by this brandied portrait of a bald, gluttonous Christ, Aziz listened, later repeating every word to the consternation of his parents, who dealt in stones and had no time for gas.
"Oh, you don't believe,"
licking his sore lips with a grin, knowing it to be the reverse of the truth.
"Your attention is wandering."
Again, he knew how furiously Aziz was hanging on to his words.
"Maybe the straw is pricking your behind, eh?"
Oh, I'm sorry, Babaji, not to provide for you silk cushions with gold brocade work. Cushions such as the Emperor Jehinga sat upon. You think of the Emperor Jehinga as a gardener only, no doubt.
Tai accused my grandfather.
Because he built Shalimar, stupid. What do you know? His name meant encompasser of the earth. Is that a gardener's name? God knows what they teach you boys these days. Whereas I,
puffing up a little here,
I knew his precise way to the Tola. Ask me how many mords, how many seers. When he was happy, he got heavier, and in Kashmir, he was heaviest of all. I used to carry his litter. No, no, look, you don't believe again. That big cucumber in your face is waggling, like the little one in your pajamas. So come on, come on, ask me questions. Give examination. Ask how many times the leather thongs wound around the handles of the litter. The answer is 31. Ask me, what was the Emperor's dying word? I tell you, it was Kashmir. He had bad breath and a good heart. Who do you think I am? Some common, ignorant, lying pie dog? Go, get out of the boat now. Your nose makes it too heavy to row. Also, your father is waiting to beat my gas out of you, and your mother to boil off your skin.
In the brandy bottle of the boatman Tai, I see foretold my own father's possession by jinns. And there will be another bald foreigner. And Tai's gas prophecies another kind, which was the consolation of my grandmother's old age and taught her stories too. And pie dogs aren't far away. Enough. I'm frightening myself. Despite beating and boiling, Adam Aziz floated with Tai in his shikara again and again, amid goats, hay, flowers, furniture, lotus roots, though never with the English sobs, and heard again and again the miraculous answers to that single terrifying question. But Taji, how old are you, honestly? From Tai, Adam learned the secrets of the lake, where you could swim without being pulled down by the weeds, the 11 varieties of water snake, where the frogs spawned, how to cook a lotus root, and where the 3 English women had drowned a few years back. There is a tribe of Feringi women who come to this water to drown, Tai said. Sometimes they know it, sometimes they don't. But I know the minute I smell them. They hide under the water from God knows what or who, but they can't hide from me, Baba. Tai's laugh emerging to infect Adam, a huge booming laugh that seemed macabre when it crashed out of that old withered body, but which was so natural in my giant grandfather that nobody knew in later times that it wasn't really his. My uncle Hanif inherited this laugh, so until he died, a piece of Tai lived in Bombay. And, also from Tai, my grandfather heard about noses. Tai tapped his left nostril.
You know what this is, Naku? It is the place where the outside world meets the world inside you. If they don't get on, you feel it here. Then you rub your nose with embarrassment to make the itch go away. A nose like that, little idiot, is a great gift, I say. Trust it. When it warns you, look out, or you'll be finished. Follow your nose and you'll go far.
He cleared his throat. His eyes rolled away into the mountains of the past. Aziz settled back on the straw.
I knew one officer once in the army of that Iskandar the Great. Never mind his name. He had a vegetable just like yours hanging between his eyes. When the army halted near Gandhara, he fell in love with some local floozy. At once his nose itched like crazy. He scratched it, but that was useless. He inhaled vapours from crushed boiled eucalyptus leaves. Still no good, Baba. The itching sent him wild. But the damn fool dug in his heels and stayed with his little witch when the army went home. He became what? A stupid thing. Neither this nor that. A half and halfer with a nagging wife and an itch in the nose. And in the end, he pushed his sword into his stomach. What do you think of that?
Dr. Aziz in 1915, whom rubies and diamonds have turned into a half and halfer, remembers this story as Tai enters hailing distance. His nose is itching still. He scratches, shrugs, tosses his head, and then Tai shouts,
"Oh, hey, Dr. Saab! Ghani, the landowner's daughter, is sick!"
The message, delivered curtly, shouted unceremoniously across the surface of the lake, although boatman and pupil have not met for half a decade, mouthed by woman's lips that are not smiling in long-time no-see greeting, sends time into a speeding whirligig, blurry fluster of excitement. "Just think, son," Adam's mother is saying as she sips fresh lime water, reclining on a tuct, in an attitude of resigned exhaustion, "how life does turn out. For so many years even my ankles were a secret, and now I must be stared at by strange persons who are not even family members." While Ghani the landowner stands beneath a large oil painting of Diana the Huntress, framed in squiggly gold, he wears thick, dark glasses and his famous poisonous smile and disgust art.
"I purchased it from an Englishman down on his luck, Dr. Saab. 500 rupees only, and I did not trouble to beat him down. What are 500 chips? You see, I am a lover of culture."
"See, my son," Adam's mother is saying as he begins to examine her, "what a mother will not do for her child. Look how I suffer. You are a doctor. Feel these rashes, these blotchy bits. Understand that my head aches morning, noon, and night. Refill my glass, child." But the young doctor has entered the throes of a most unhippocratic excitement at the boatman's cry and shouts,
"I'm coming just now. Just let me bring my things."
The Shikara's prow touches the garden's hem. Adam is rushing indoors, prayer mat rolled like a cheroot under one arm, blue eyes blinking in the sudden interior gloom. He has placed the cheroot on a high shelf on top of stacked copies of Vauvert's and Lenin's What is to be Done, and other pamphlets, dusty echoes of his half-faded German life. He is pulling out from under his bed a second-hand leather case which his mother called his Doctori Attaché, and as he swings it and himself upwards and runs from the room, the word Heidelberg is briefly visible, burned into the leather on the bottom of the bag. A landowner's daughter is good news indeed to a doctor with a career to make, even if she is ill. No, because she is ill. While I sit, like an empty pickle jar in a pool of angelpoise light, visited by this vision of my grandfather 63 years ago, which demands to be recorded, filling my nostrils with the acrid stench of his mother's embarrassment, which has brought her out in boils, with the vinegary force of Adam Aziz's determination to establish a practice so successful that she'll never have to return to the gemstone shop, with the blind mustiness of a big shadowy house in which the young doctor stands, ill at ease, before a painting of a plain girl with lively eyes and a stag transfixed behind her on the horizon, speared by a dart from her bow. Most of what matters in our lives takes place in our absence. But I seem to have found from somewhere the trick of filling in the gaps in my knowledge, so that everything is in my head down to the last detail, such as the way the mist seemed to slant across the early morning air. Everything, and not just the few clues one stumbles across, for instance by opening an old tin trunk which should have remained cobwebby and closed. Adam refills his mother's glass and continues, worriedly, to examine her.
"Put some cream on these rashes and blotches, Amma. For the headache, there are pills. The boils must be lanced. But maybe if you wore purdah when you sat in the store, so that no disrespectful eyes could..." Such complaints often begin in the mind.
Slap of oar in water. Plop of spittle in lake. Tai clears his throat and mutters angrily,
"A fine business! A vetted Naku child goes away before he's learned one damn thing, and he comes back a big Dr. Saab with a big bag full of foreign machines, and he's still as silly as an owl, I swear! A too bad business."
Dr. Aziz is shifting uneasily from foot to foot, under the influence of the landowner's smile, in whose presence it is not possible to feel relaxed, and is waiting for some tick of reaction to his own extraordinary appearance. He has grown accustomed to these involuntary twitches of surprise at his size. his face of many colours, his nose. But Ghani makes no sign, and the young doctor resolves, in return, not to let his uneasiness show. He stops shifting his weight. They face each other, each suppressing, or so it seems, his view of the other, establishing the basis of their future relationship. And now Ghani alters, changing from an art lover to tough guy.
"This is a big chance for you, young man," he says,
Aziz's eyes have strayed to Diana. Wide expanses of her blemished pink skin are visible. His mother is moaning, shaking her head.
"No, what do you know, child? You have become a big-shot doctor, but the gemstone business is different. Who would buy a turquoise from a woman hidden inside a black hood? It is a question of establishing trust, so they must look at me, and I must get pains and boils. Go, go, don't worry your head about your poor mother."
"Big shot," Tai is spitting into the lake. "Big bag, big shot. Pah! We haven't got enough bags at home that you must bring back that thing made of a pig skin that makes one unclean just by looking at it? And inside, God knows what all."
Dr. Aziz, seated amongst flowery curtains and the smell of incense, has his thoughts wrenched away from the patient waiting across the lake. Tai's bitter monologue breaks into his consciousness, creating a sense of dull shock, a smell like a casualty ward overpowering the incense. The old man is clearly furious about something, possessed by an incomprehensible rage that appears to be directed at his erstwhile acolyte, or, more precisely and oddly, at his bag. Dr. Aziz attempts to make small talk.
"Your wife is well? Do they still talk about your bag of golden teeth?"
Tries to remake an old friendship, but Tai is in full flight now, a stream of invective pouring out of him. The Heidelberg bag quakes under the torrent of abuse.
"Sister sleeping pigskin bag from abroad full of foreigners' tricks? Big shot bag! Now, if a man breaks an arm, that bag will not let the bone setter bind it in leaves. Now a man must let his wife lie beside that bag and watch knives come and cut her open. Ha, fine business! What these foreigners put in our young men's heads, I swear! It is a too bad thing! That bag should fry in hell with the testicles of the ungodly!"
Ghani, the landowner, snaps his braces with his thumbs.
"A big chance, yes, indeed. They are saying good things about you in town. Good medical training, good, good enough family. And now our own lady doctor is sick, so you get your opportunity. That woman always sick these days, too old, I'm thinking, and not up in the latest developments also. What, what? I say, physician, heal thyself. And I tell you this, I am wholly objective in my business relations. Feelings, love, I keep for my family only. If a person is not doing a first-class job for me, out she goes. You understand me? So, my daughter Nazim is not well. You will treat her excellently. Remember, I have friends, and ill health strikes high and low alike."
"Do you still pickle water snakes in brandy to give you virility, Taji? Do you still like to eat lotus root without any spices?" Hesitant questions brushed aside by the torrent of Tai's fury. Dr. Aziz begins to diagnose. To the ferryman, the bag represents abroad. It is the alien thing, the invader, progress. And yes, it has indeed taken possession of the young doctor's mind. And yes, it contains knives and cures for cholera and malaria and smallpox. And yes, it sits between doctor and boatman and has made them antagonists. Dr. Aziz begins to fight against sadness and against Tai's anger, which is beginning to infect him, to become his own, which erupts only rarely but comes, when it does come, unheralded in a roar from his deepest places, laying waste everything in sight, and then vanishes, leaving him wondering why everyone is so upset. They are approaching Ghani's house. A bearer awaits the shikara, standing with clasped hands on a little wooden jetty. Aziz fixes his mind on the job in hand. "Has your usual doctor agreed to my visit, Ghani Saab?" Again, a hesitant question is brushed lightly aside. The landowner says,
"Oh, she will agree. Now, follow me, please."
The bearer is waiting on the jetty, holding the Shikara steady as Adam Aziz climbs out, bag in hand. And now, at last, Tai speaks directly to my grandfather, scorn in his face. Tai asks,
"Tell me this, Dr. Saab. Have you got in that bag made of dead pigs one of those machines that foreign doctors used to smell with?"
Adam shakes his head, not understanding. Tai's voice gathers new layers of disgust.
"You know, sir, a thing like an elephant's trunk."
Aziz, seeing what he means, replies, "A stethoscope? Naturally." Tai pushes the Shikara off from the jetty, spits, begins to row away.
"I knew it," he says. "You will use such a machine now instead of your own big nose."
My grandfather does not trouble to explain that a stethoscope is more like a pair of ears than a nose. He is stifling his own irritation, the resentful anger of a cast-off child. And besides, there is a patient waiting. Time settles down and concentrates on the importance of the moment. The house was opulent but badly lit. Ghani was a widower, and the servants clearly took advantage. There were cobwebs in corners and layers of dust on ledges. They walked down a long corridor. One of the doors was ajar, and through it Aziz saw a room in a state of violent disorder. This glimpse, connected with a glint of light in Ghani's dark glasses, suddenly informed Aziz that the landowner was blind. This aggravated his sense of unease. A blind man who claimed to appreciate European paintings? He was also impressed because Ghani hadn't bumped into anything. They halted outside a thick teak door. Ghani said,
"Wait here 2 moments,"
and went into the room behind the door. In later years, Dr. Adam Aziz swore that during those 2 moments of solitude in the gloomy, spidery corridors of the landowner's mansion, he was gripped by an almost uncontrollable desire to turn and run away as fast as his legs would carry him. Unnerved by the enigma of the blind art lover, his insides filled with tiny, scrabbling insects as a result of the insidious venom of Tai's mutterings, his nostrils itching to the point of convincing him that he had somehow contracted venereal disease, he felt his feet begin slowly, as though encased in boots of lead, to turn, felt blood pounding in his temples, and was seized by so powerful a sensation of standing upon a point of no return that he very nearly wet his German woolen trousers. He began, without knowing it, to blush furiously, and at this point his mother appeared before him, seated on the floor before a low desk, a rash spreading like a blush across her face as she held a turquoise up to the light. His mother's face had acquired all the scorn of the boatman Tai.
"Go, go, run," she told him in Tai's voice. "Don't worry about your poor old mother."
Dr. Aziz found himself stammering. "What a useless son you've got, Hama. Can't you see there's a hole in the middle of me the size of a melon?" His mother smiled, a pained smile.
"You always were a heartless boy," she sighed,
and then turned into a lizard on the wall of the corridor and stuck her tongue out at him. Dr. Aziz stopped feeling dizzy, became unsure that he'd actually spoken aloud, wondered what he'd meant by that business about the hole, found that his feet were no longer trying to escape, and realized that he was being watched. A woman with the biceps of a wrestler was staring at him, beckoning him to follow her into the room.